This podcast was produced by ORFM Dunedin with support from New Zealand On the Air.
Right On, showcasing the work of Otago Southland writers. I'm Beverly Martins. Join me for news and interviews with local writers on the second Wednesday of every month from noon till 1 and replayed the following Sunday at 1pm. Right On is brought to you by the Otago Southland branch of the New Zealand Society of Authors and kindly supported by the great team at the University Bookshop.
What do you want to be when you grow up? They say you are what you read, and the University Bookshop can help you be whoever you want to be. Do you want to be an athlete? Then sit down with an inspiring sports biography. Do you fancy yourself as a detective? We have a grisly lineup of murder mysteries waiting just for you. Do you aspire to be the world's greatest chef? We have cookbooks to tantalise your taste buds. Do you want to celebrate your inner child? Play up in our fabulous children's room. The University Bookshop, helping you decide what you want to be when you grow up.
Hello and welcome to Write On with me, Beverly Martins. Now, let me ask you a very timely question. Are you thinking about tinsel or turkey, or are you thinking about the headspace a much-needed break might give you to regain your creative focus? Well, if it's the latter, this final show is my holiday gift to you. First up, draw inspiration from 70-year-old poet John Russell Hodge, whose new purpose gets him up each morning. And later, we'll hear from friend of the show and former host, Vanda Simon, about the New Zealand Society of Authors Mentor Program, which has provided invaluable practical support time and time again for beginning writers to get their work up to a publishable standard. And of course, within that, we're going to tell you how to apply. So first up, here's John sharing the adventurous way he's going to be spending his summer holidays. So I'm now talking with the new Robert Lord Summer Writer in Residence, John Russell Hodge. Congratulations, John. What was your reaction when you were selected?
Total disbelief. I think as I mentioned to you yesterday, it's sort of kind of unusual at the age of 70 to be considered an emerging anything. So it's just a huge joy. I had an indication that my poetry was liked because the judges wrote to me before to say how much they had been moved by my poetry, but I didn't think that was necessarily one of their main criteria.
Right.
So it's actually about 10 days afterwards for Amanda from the bookshop to say I'd won was just incredible.
Yeah. Now, that's Amanda Kingsby, the general manager of UBS, who are the sort of part sponsors of the Robert Lord Summer Writer in Residence.
Yeah.
So, listen, obviously it was incredibly welcome news after, you know, what's been a very few rough years for you, really, hasn't it? Do you want to give us a little bit of background?
Well, yes, I suppose so. I came to New Zealand in 96, been working as a workaholic in management consultancy and moved much to various places around New Zealand. I say we had reasonable amount of misfortune. In 2024, we had a house fire up on the peninsula when we were living in Dunedin, which was a huge affair. It made the TV1 and TV3 front line and front page of the ODT. And I just started working back in Wellington, commuting. And so we decided to go back to Wellington, but always wanted to return to Dunedin, which we did in 2015 when I retired. But we wanted to build a house because after we moved back to Wellington, Chris had an operation which went wrong, unfortunately. So she ended up becoming increasingly disabled. And that really set the pattern for our life from that point onwards. So we moved back to Dunedin wanting to build a house for her. And in the end, I got driven out by the hills to come to Waimate. So we moved up just before COVID broke out, or rather we bought a house in Waimate just before then, which I spent months and months doing up, which is where I am now, but with the intent of building a house next door, which we didn't actually do. So when Chris got ill in 2023 and went into hospital, as usual I did with these events, started a diary, and that quickly became some poems, which I'd written off and on over the years, but maybe only 20 or 30. And I started getting really interested in the poetry once Chris had died as a way of just thinking things through, I suppose.
So much so that I mean, she died in October, just over 2 years ago now, wasn't it, John? And so much so that, the sort of solace and the routine of writing, of expressing your thoughts, you resolved in early of 2024 to write a poem a day. Is that, and that you've largely done that, haven't you?
I think there's been about 1 or 2 days where I've missed it and I've written poems about that. But I think a large part of it was with Chris being disabled, we had lots of different routines associated with getting up and getting ready for bed and all those sorts of things. So the poetry almost became a part of that, that I could get to bed and then find out I hadn't written a poem. So I had a routine of writing a poem in bed. So my goal every morning is to get up and make sure I write a poem before I go to bed. And I fail quite often. But yeah, I would say there's probably no more than 3 days that I've missed, and I've immediately corrected that by writing two poems the next day. So yeah, it's pretty much an absolute for me to do that.
And indirectly, having this body of work, led you to apply for the residency, but there were a lot of building blocks along the way, weren't there? I mean, you got connected into the other poets, writing groups, that kind of thing. Can you give us a quick précis of that? Because I think that that's, if you had been sitting at home writing poems and then you got a residency, well, that just wouldn't happen, would it? I mean, it's
No.
incremental, isn't it? And you have to be connected, and also that gives you, I think, the encouragement to, stop whistling in the dark, and feel like you're getting somewhere. So can you just give our listeners a quick précis of sort of how some of those key building blocks, because I think that's really useful for people to know.
Yeah, I mean, the first thing I suppose really was that poetry was the first thing I turned to after Chris died. Luckily for a lot of us in South Canterbury, there was a new group, the South Canterbury Live Poets, which started in November of 23. So their first meeting was 3 weeks after she died. And it was really the first thing I put myself out to do. Obviously, during that period, it was really tough. So I went to the first meeting. There's no, it's basically an open mic. And I didn't say anything in the first meeting, but I started at the next meeting. And so a couple of meetings later was when I decided in February to write a poem every day. So that was probably the first, well, probably the main sort of thrust into me writing poems more regularly. As I'd also been a member of the OWL group.
I'll just catch listeners up there. OWL stands for Otapoti Writers Lab, and it was a really key component of the lovely Emily Duncan and HJ Kilcally, who formed Prospect Park down here and were created a whole supportive community of writers until they ran out of steam themselves, didn't they? Because it was just really hard and in such funding difficult times and things to keep going. But they really did spurn a lot of groups and fellowship.
Yes, absolutely. I mean, we met physically before COVID, but then when I moved away, I sort of dropped out a bit. But I resumed the Zoom discussions that were being held with various other poets like Liz Breslin and Eliana Gray and various other people. But just as I got back into that, as you say, they ran out of steam. And Eliana Gray kind of took up the reins by asking if people were still interested in going forward with a paid group rather than the free group that OWL had been. And there were enough people to go with that. So there's a nest group that formed after OWL fell over, which Ellie is mentoring or leading the discussions on. And that meets once a month, and it's fortnightly as well, because there's an extra group being put on for those who's really keen. And so I had this huge block of poems that was mounting daily and weighing down on me.
Oh,
And
was
I
it?
wasn't
Why
sure if they were any good.
was it weighing down on you? Were you not quite sure what to do with them, or?
Yeah, pressure from people saying, "What are you going to do with all these poems?" And I just didn't know. It was I wouldn't say it was Sisyphus, but there was this huge rock of poems growing and growing and growing, and I didn't know what to do with it. And one day in July, I wrote a poem which sort of clicked for me, and I realized that I thought was the last poem in the book. And so I decided to write what the first poem might be in the book. And so once I'd done that on the same day, because I should say quite often, hey, you get to 1,000 poems by writing more than one poem a day. So, I mean, the most I've done in a day was 16, but I think alcohol was involved.
And do you remember how many of those you kept, or was the answer actually none of them?
No, I keep them all. I mean, I keep them all, and then I just look at them and think, well, who wrote that? But on that day in July, so I had the what I thought were the bookends for a book. And so that sort of staked out the journey. And so I just decided arbitrarily on 12, 13 headings that would map from A to B. And I've just gone about like crazy working through all of the poems to put them under those headings. I don't think the headings will appear in the book. And I don't think they're necessarily, you know, quite often a poem could go in more than one category. But it's certainly a way in to sort of wedge the poems apart and break the rock up into manageable pieces. So as it stands at the moment, and that really was the large part of my proposal for the residency, was to work through that process. So I've got a target in my mind to get all 1,000 plus, it'll be about 1,100 by the time I start the residency, all of them categorised under the different headings. And it's quite an elaborate process. And what's been really interesting for me is that I've used my management consultancy techniques with spreadsheets and mind maps and goodness knows what to control it all. And it's working out. It's probably the best management process I've designed. And it just works really well for me to be able to, you know, get my hands around so many poems. And once I decided on the nature of the book and what it was about, then I just asked Ellie if she'd mentor me. And they were happy to agree. And so I've been working with Ellie. And at this moment, we're at about, I've put... Because my process is quite interesting. As I use business process, I dictate my poems. I hardly ever write them down. So I dictate them into my phone and then I'll edit them to put in line breaks and correct all the typos that you get when you dictate. But that then involves me taking it out of that software and putting it into Word. And then so that Ellie can review them, I then put them into Google Drive. So all along that process, for example, Ellie's started, or she's been, they've been doing some edits today. And every time they edit something, I get an email from Google Drive explaining with a link to the poem what the comments are. And it's just fantastic because I can see, and I've got a record of every poem that Ellie's looked at. And when she did it, so I'm measuring her productivity as well, which we think is fun. So I've got this really good process for getting my head around it. So at the moment, so I've done about 760 poems into Word out of my phone, and Ellie has now reviewed nearly 300 of them, now, which is just amazing.
Just to be clear, you because Ellie will look at it and maybe make three or four comments on one poem, you don't get a blimmin' alert on every comment. You get it on every poem, don't you?
Like every poem,
one per poem.
So I get an email which will have a link at the top to the poem in Google Drive and then a summary of all the comments that Ellie's made against that in the body of the email.
Right, brilliant.
And so then I'm we've set them up as categories as to whether a poem is in the book or out of the book, whether it's a straight reject, whether it's a home run but needs some
tweaking.
Tweaking, exactly the right word. And a few others, like maybe this poem should be amalgamated with other poems.
Right. Yeah.
I've ended up with a five different poems all about distraction. So I thought they might all end up as one, but we both quite like them as they are. So maybe there'll be five poems about distraction in the book. So where we're heading, say, is I'm planning by the end of the residency to get down to about 200, 250 poems, which are eligible. And I think we probably want to target 70 to 80 poems for the book. Different processes in place, at which I've got a meeting with Eddie tomorrow where we're going to go through the cull process. But I see it as it's a three-stage thing, that we go from the 1,000 plus down to about 2 to 300 and then 2 to 300 using different criteria to get to the last lot. And the main criteria, which is going to be really different for that last phase, is going to be see how they hang together as a body of work up till the end of this next process where we get down to 200 to 300. I think we'll be still basically looking at the quality of the individual poem. But after that, it will be a case of then saying, well, these three poems, we're all hanging in the same space. Is it that we create a new, or I create a new poem out of them? Or is that one so markedly better than the other two that we drop them or steal a line or whatever? So there's going to be quite a bit of sort of marquetry going on, I think, towards the end of the book. And even in all honesty, I think, and Ellie's advised me, that the book might be completely different from what I envisage now. It really is. I was hoping that in going through all these edits that I'm doing, that things would emerge, which they are. For example, I have a fantastic ability to undermine the message of a poem by going for stupid rhymes. And I've got five or six poems where just think, well, this is a really good poem, if only it didn't rhyme
So
in such a gift card way.
in effect, you sometimes go for style, and that affects the content.
Yeah, I go for an easy rhyme, or I just decide at the start of a poem, because effectively most of my poems, I would say 99% of my poems start with the first line. And if you imagine me lying in bed, desperate to go to sleep, desperate to get rid of a poem, so I pick a line, and I let it wander wherever it needs to go. So I think very much I pluck, I don't create the poems, I think they find me. Sometimes I'll kick off a poem and start with silly rhymes, and they'll go on for the rest of the poem. And then I get to the end of the poem and think, well, actually, that's quite a decent poem about quite a sensible, serious subject. And then Ellie will look at it and think, well, these rhymes get in the way. And I think they're absolutely right. That's just something. They're sort of placeholder poems, that there's something right about the poem, but there's a huge lot that's wrong as well. So we've got a category for that where, this poem needs serious attention if it's going to make the book. But initially, we had a hit rate of, I think, the first 300 poems, about 270 were all possibles for the book, which is where I came up with that, we're going to have about 700 to knock out. I'm glad to say that the rejection rate has gone up quite a lot. But even then, it's fun. I mean, as I said to you before we had the session, this meeting, when Ellie is editing or reviewing, I mean, it's quite tight guidelines about what they're doing. It's not to do a real edit on the poem. It simply is it in or out as the first, or
Just
is it
about.
in with a bit of attention? So it's a very rough cut sort of thing, which means, again, I want to go back through all the ones that were rejected at the end just to see if there's any gems that haven't made the cut. As Ellie goes through them, she typically, sorry, they typically do them in a block. But I get, as I said, an email for each one. So as they go through them, my inbox just fills up with all these messages from Ellie. And it's like I've taken photographs of my inbox and sent them to them, just saying it's like a waterfall. And I was mowing the lawn the other day, and they started doing some edits, and my phone notifications kept going off. So I just had this tinkling going on. And it's wonderful, and an unexpected joy, to have that feedback, and it's so real.
So, in terms of you being down here, then that's an extra blessing, isn't it? Because you will be
Yes.
able to work with Eliana in person,
Yep.
and you know exactly what you're doing. Because some people will have an idea of something, and then they'll be sitting in the cottage and think, "Ooh," and start doubting themselves or something. But it sounds like you're so far into this project that you can just keep going and be really productive while you're down here. Have you got any other goals while you're going to be here in Dunedin?
I would like to engage with the local community in terms of doing some readings or whatever. So that's something I'll try and pursue. I do want also to think whether this approach that I'm having towards, because I mean, we've still talked a little about the book, but not really about the content and the purpose of the book. I've been hit enormously by Chris's death. When someone's disabled, your whole social life retreats. So over 20 years of that, we basically became closer and closer, and we moved to Moray Matta to build a house, which is a community I don't know. So now I'm basically, quite alone here and working through that grief. But then when you think there's about 30, was it 35,000 people a year die in New Zealand, So if you're standing in New World, there's probably 10% of the people around you are dealing with grief of a close friend or a loved one in the family. And yet we have no mechanism for really dealing with that. Mm. And so I want to make something that's accessible and slightly different. And that's really, I think, the biggest journey or the biggest lesson that's going to come out of the next 2-3 stages is thinking, well, how do I make this more accessible? Because there are lots of poetry books about grief, and you know, it's also one of the prime drivers why people write. But I just kind of want to do something a bit different. And so part of me thinks, well, is that something that could be applied to another writer? So I want to dip into the Hocken to see if there are some collections there that might be the next book or whatever after this one. So that's an aim as well. But that's about, I imagine, you know, half a day a week or something, unless I find something really engaging, in which case I'll give that more time.
I think the 6 weeks are going to go by very quickly.
Yes.
I really do. I really do. John, are you familiar with the cottage? Do you know it?
I've not seen it, but I've been street mapping it.
Right.
Quite a lot, and I've got the description of it, and I've spoken to Gail Zing about it as well. She was the last poet with this spot.
Right.
And all she would tell me is that all the light switches are very high up.
Well, the good
because
news,
Robert was very tall.
Yes, and the good news is that you're here in the summer, so you can utilise the small garden and things, because, I mean, the whole thing is pretty tiny. I mean, you're living in a cottage now, but, you know, this is essentially two rooms. But,
well, I've said to Vanessa Manhire that I'm going to spend the whole 6 weeks standing up.
But also, yeah, as I say, you've kind of got that garden space, and it's a quiet time of the year because, you know, obviously Titan Street is student central.
Yes.
But they will be away, so yeah, we'll have access to sort of some of the green space North Dunedin too. I think it's going to be fantastic. I mean, you sound incredibly well kind of organised and looking forward to it. And also, I think you would be taking heart in the fact that, as you say, this is going to be accessible for other people and things. And that's, you might going to, you know, there's going to be a point when you're going to switch ahead to think of, you know, reader response, because this is, you know, so personal for you, but you want to, you know, the personal can become political, can't it? I think that sounds like your aim. Really great to chat. I'm really looking forward to meeting you in person when you do come back down to Dunedin, and also, you know, hearing your work read aloud at probably the Octagon Poetry Collective or any other readings that the bookshop might organise for you, etc. So can we end now, John, please? Can you choose one or two of your poems? Not easy to do with your vast stash, and you might be fiddling with your choice right now based on Eliana's feedback. But if just so we can get a bit of a flavour for, you know, what we might be hearing and reading later.
Right, so I'll start off with somebody at the South Canterbury Live Poets said, "I don't think I'd buy your book because I don't think I'd want to buy a book full of poems about death." So some of my poems are a bit more jovial, but I'll start with, I think, something more profound. This is called Poems of Death. I want to write all the poems of death, to use up all the words, to crush and break them on the bouldering beaches that we combed with our love all those years ago. If only love and joy can remain under Prussian blue skies, chromium sun and titanium white clouds, casting words of cooling shade on those left behind, scorched by death and your forsaken brush. I would take it as a noble task to rend the skies with words and cries that save all others from the need to ask, what words can save my breaking heart?
Mm. Lovely.
So that's one. And one of the things I found living on my own, which I'm unused to, obviously, is my memory fails me. So this is a poem about that. And it's called I Made Myself a Sausage Sandwich. I made myself a sausage sandwich. I don't have any reference points or conversations. My mind is playing tricks because I no longer pay attention. I made myself a sausage sandwich, which was really nice, except it was bacon and it wasn't a sandwich. It was an open French stick, but other than that, all details were correct. Like saying I am me when every part of my body is replaced by my scheduled and unscheduled maintenance department. Your death caught my attention, eclipsing life itself. It erases my purpose, like a sausage sandwich without the bread and no sausage.
Oh, John, they're great. And I'm so pleased you've got this residency for a variety of reasons. One, I think it's going to, it's going to move you through what's been a really tough time. It's going to give you something that you and Christine will both be very proud of. So there's those reasons. But separately, big thumbs up for ageism not being alive and well. In terms of,
I'm
because
emerging.
yeah, well, it's you know, it's quite easy to think of that. You think all the sort of emerging writers are young, gifted, and slack. And so I think it's great that this has come along at exactly the right time for you, and
Yes.
It's given you heart, but it's going to give us heart as well. So thank you very much, John. Pleasure, and we look forward to seeing you here in sunny Dunners.
Thank you, Beverly.
Now, I asked my guests to choose their favourite New Zealand song, and their answers often surprise me. No more so than this choice from John, who requested it, and which I'm happy to play now. And it's Dame Kirui Te Kānawa singing an incredibly iconic New Zealand song. Now, it's my pleasure to welcome back Vanda Simon, whom I last talked to well over a year ago, wasn't it, Vanda? So before we discuss the main topic of the mentorships, which is, you'll be wearing your rather large NZSA president's hat to talk about that, let's just recap. How's 2025 been for you? The highlights, challenges?
It has been an extraordinarily challenging year. I'll be quite upfront about that. Highlights would have to be, gosh, I should think of some highlights. I did actually manage to write and finish writing a book, my next book, which is called Reaper, which will be coming out in May. Lowlights, probably there were many, but I think probably one of the biggest challenges was having a visual challenges come out of the blue that I wasn't expecting, right out of left field, that have been rather permanent.
So, can you just elaborate on that? How's it affected your work and your creative life?
So, what happened was I developed something called vitreo macular traction. So, what that means is it's just part of the aging process. They don't tell you about all these things that come along potentially with aging. And in your eye, the vitreous humor inside your eyeball, just with time and age, thickens slightly. And so it thickens and it will pull away from the retina in the back of your eye. And for the vast, vast majority of people, this happens and you don't even notice it happens. Then you get some special people where a little bit of it will stick to the tissues in the back of your eye, and as it shrinks, it pulls and delaminates the layers of your retina and rips a hole. So I had this happen in both of my eyes.
At the
And
same time.
so one sort of went before the other, and one was further advanced than the other. And what that meant was I ended up having to have surgery in my right eye. And unfortunately for me too, where the holes ripped in both eyes are exactly central vision. So whatever I looked at before surgery, I couldn't see. It was just like a funny white static television hole, and lots of visual distortions around it as well. So it was interesting, like, if you're driving along, when I was driving, the lines on the road were all wiggling and moving. They still do now. So I had to have surgery in my right eye, and it's gloriously gruesome surgery. It's like fascinating. Because they hope you're not squeamish out there, people. But they, you know, they put a needle in your needles in your eye. They suck out the vitreous humour, scrape the cells in the back of your retina, and put in a gas bubble. And having a gas bubble is really interesting because of the pressure thing. You're not allowed to fly. You're not allowed to go over 300 metres above sea level for like 8 weeks until the gas bubble dissolves. And bodies are amazing. Your eye resorbs that gas bubble and replaces it with fluid. And so you start off after the surgery completely blind in that eye, and then you get a tide line, literally a tide line.
That moves down.
That moves down as the liquid fills up and the gas resorbs. And then hopefully after that, you know, your vision is improved.
Which?
Sort of. So the hole in that eye is smaller, but there has been some like permanent other blind spots that weren't there before surgery. But the net result of it all is that I can see well enough to drive, which is fantastic. But for, you know, it's quite a visual impairment. For example, you know, you're 2-3 metres away and I can't see your face properly because of where the holes are. Yeah. But for someone who works on screens all day, of course, that provides quite a few challenges for writing books. Yeah.
Gosh, what a... I feel like we could have done the whole interview on this. And do you know what struck me is that I knew that you would research the hell out of it, which you've done, because that's you. You know, like, right, I've got this. I want to know everything. But also, you know, as you say about the squeamish thing, I mean, you always go there because you're a crime writer.
Yeah.
So you're going to want to know this stuff. And I can see that you're sort of filing it away, thinking, this is material I can use later. That's going to pop up. Some version of it is going to pop up in one of your books.
Yes.
I can just.
But it also makes you wonder a wee bit about history because, you know, as part of all the visual distortions and things, you know, I was seeing things really strangely, still do. And it makes you wonder, you know, historically, over centuries, how many people were experiencing these visual distortions and people thought that, they were seeing things and they were witchcraft. Or
they thought they were going mad.
Yeah, that's true.
Yeah. You're right. Medical science, we can now, you know, we have an explanation and we generally have a solution.
Yeah.
So we'll just wrap that part up because we need to move on to the main topic. But can you tell me, are you using, like with your scripts and things, are they in your writing, are you using like voice generated stuff and reading back to you? Like, how have you adapted your practice?
So I have everything on my screen. I have to have a big extra additional screen. I have everything blown up really big, and then the strongest reading glasses I can have.
Mm-hmm.
And that kind of works okay to an extent. But the things like numbers, eights and sixes and nines, some letters just look the same.
Right.
I have not gone down the path of voice things because in my previous experience of using them, that was really clunky and I got frustrated by it. So I just persist with just using a key. And I've got a keyboard with like big keys.
Right.
With larger from the Blind Foundation keyboard.
I was going to say, you're getting support from Low Vision New Zealand, I think they call themselves.
I just got a few aids and a few, you know, magnifying apps and things like that.
Brilliant.
But we muddle along. You adapt to anything.
Oh, I mean, and you're incredible. And I mean, if one thing I know about you, Vanda, you're tenacious. You know, like you do, you juggle a lot. You always have done. You know, your home life, your working life, your creative life, you know, president of NZSA, you know, as if you didn't need more to do, et cetera, et cetera. So let's put that hat on, because the whole theme of this final program is to talk about kind of things over the break that you might want to do or don't know how to do and want some help, that kind of thing. And this is the perfect timing to talk about the NZSA mentorships, because they opened last week and the application process is open till the 1st of February. So you know, people out there who want to apply and who should apply, because, you know, we're going to tell you how great they are in a minute, and they really are. They've got such a fantastic track record. That will give you the opportunity to make a decent, you know, the best application you can, because they are highly contested, obviously. Mm. So let's just go now to the sort of the what of it. You know, what are they? How do they work?
So the New Zealand Society of Authors mentorship programs, the mentorships allow or give, a full mentorship is 25 hours of time with an established writer, someone who has published many books, has had experience in the field. And within that is the opportunity not just for simply getting a manuscript, you know, looked over by someone who's a writer. It's far more than that. You know, they have a separate program for that, the manuscript assessment program, if you just want your manuscript assessed. But with a mentorship, you get the benefit of being able to, over a period of 7 to 8 months, build a relationship with this writer, you know, pick their brains, not just learn about crafting your own work, but, you know, you can learn professionally about what life is like as an author, and just build that confidence.
It's a real buddy system, isn't it?
It really, really is. And the lovely thing about the mentorship program is that you can tailor it around to what you need. So, you know, there's not a set way that any mentor is going to do it with any one mentee. You know, I've mentored a number of people, and what we do is we find out what the needs are for the writer that we are working with, and, you know, and just run with that, working best to how they're going to benefit the most from the program.
And also the way that you do it, the how of it has got, you know, you can do it in various ways too. You know, if you live near them, you can have some face-to-face meetings, you can have phone calls, you can have emails, you can do it over Zoom. So you know, that 25 hours, you can spread it out to suit yourself. And I know a lot of people, you know, make a regular check, and I don't know, maybe every fortnight or once a month or something. But obviously when you get the feedback then you from your mentor, then you need the time to sort of take that on board and, you know, improve your work and then get back to them and things like that. So that, you know, the 8 months or so, it's usually from about April to December, is very important, I think. You know, you don't barrel in there and think, oh, I'm going to have a week with them. It's not deep immersion here. Yeah. It's slow and steady, isn't it?
Yeah, it's a realistic time frame, because as you are writing, in that process of writing, things change, things come up, your whole view of your manuscript changes, your mood with the manuscript changes. I love it, I hate it, I love it, I hate it. I don't want to see it ever again. And you've got the support there of an author who's been there, done that, tick it off, got the t-shirt, and can, you know, just talk you through these things and the ups and the downs and the lows, and also you can request, you know, what author you want. You can put forward suggestions of who you'd like. So you can specifically ask for someone in your field of writing.
Yeah,
so,
in,
you
know, your genre.
So if you're writing crime fiction, you can ask for, you know, this crime fiction author.
Poets.
And so it is really, really tailored to your needs.
Right. So how do they go about applying? Like, what's the sort of... It's sort of kind of three key steps as I see it.
So everything's done online, of course, nowadays, and there is an online application form there. You do also need to, you know, have a manuscript in process, and because it is highly contestable, you need to
show your work
and also describe, you know, what you are wanting to achieve from this
experience. And send in the most polished version of it too. You know.
Because, you know, we're not expecting, you know, a completely finished manuscript or anything like that. We're wanting to be able to see that this person is actually going to really, really benefit from a mentorship.
And commit to it and, have enough, either some work in progress, but have a bit of a plan.
Yes.
Like where they want to get to and things. So obviously the website is authors.org.nz, and the sort of three key steps that I have sort of researched is, you know, you take a look at the guidelines and see if you fit that. And it is open to members of NZSA, obviously, because, you know, that's one of the criteria. And the rules and, you know, things like that. And second, then, as you were saying, Vanda, you look at the mentors list and you see, you know, people you might know or know of or particularly love their work that or something about them that you want. Now, you don't always get your first choice, I think. Was it two or three choices you put down? Yeah. And then, of course, you fill out the form. So how long, I mean, absolutely top flight mentors in there. Mm. I think you're one of them, just to add to your workload there. Yes. Michelle Alvey, and Michaela Nyman, both well-known sort of local poets. We're going to still claim
Michaela.
Yeah, because we love her. And Michelle's our local branch president. And then there's writers like Stephanie Johnson, also Harriet Allen, who's got a long former career in publishing. And
yes, a very astute person.
Yeah, and ditto Jeff Walker on that level. How long, do you know how long the mentorship program has been going?
Oh, an awfully long time. Yeah. I can't remember offhand.
Feels like about 15 years, but I don't know. That. Yeah, maybe 20 years. Yeah. I'm not sure.
And it's one of those programs that's very very special, and we're very very grateful for the support of Creative New Zealand and being who funds these programs, because it's a very important part of the professional development that we can offer as an organisation to people. And I know for me as a mentor, it's so exciting when you do, a mentorship with someone, and then you see them through, and then you see their book published, and then sometimes you see their book published, and it's up for rewards and things like that. And
it's a
wonderfully satisfying two-way street.
Yeah, sure. Mm. Yeah, that you're helping them, and then you're getting that kind of
a nice warm
reward.
Glow inside.
Yeah, of course. Excellent. Is there anything else you want to add about the mentorships?
Even if you're unsure if you're going to get one or anything like that, put your hat in the ring, because when they're looking through the applicants for mentorships, they are trying to find across a broad spread of people, across a broad spread of abilities, across a broad spread of genres. So, if you have got a word.
And diversity, too. Diversity, absolute really diversity. Important. Diversity of the writers and diversity of the subject matter, I would think, too.
Yeah, so, put your head in the ring. Yeah. You won't get one if you don't apply.
I also think there's nothing like a deadline for actually getting your act together, is there? So you could, it's good to treat it as an exercise, too. So put your best foot forward, polish your work. What's the harm in that? Absolutely none. Get all your ducks in a row, UE writing CV, that kind of thing. Because I find when you do these things, sometimes it crystallises your own thinking, and it also means that, as you say, if you weren't successful, you've kind of set your own goals for the year anyway, for 2026.
No, you put yourself in a good place.
Yeah.
And there's always something affirming about, doing that, about applying for something, even if you're not successful, you've been brave enough to claim that I am a writer.
Yeah, I was
going to
say, you're
this.
Claiming that space. Yep. Yes, absolutely. Because it's, it is a solitary thing. It is, you're not doing it for the money. You've often got a day job as well, et cetera, et cetera. Uh-huh. So there are lots of reasons to kind of talk yourself out of it. And I think these opportunities.
No, so talk yourself into it, people.
Yeah. Excellent. So as we said, the website to look up, most of you will know this anyway, but I'll just repeat it, is authors.org.nz, and then you'll see the programs, professional development, and you'll see the whole, all you need to know about the mentorship program. And you've got the summer to do it, because the final deadline is, you can send them in early, of course, but the final deadline is the 1st of February. So thanks, Vanda. Really great to catch up. Now tell us about your new book, just briefly. Ooh. We've got a couple of minutes, so let's hear it. I mean, I last spoke to you about Prey, which I loved, and this is another Sam Shepherd that you've done?
No,
it's a standalone.
This is a slightly different one. So my standalone novel that I had previously written called Faceless was set in Auckland. And so this is a follow-up to Faceless. So the character Max and the character Meredith come back in this. And it's the second in what's now going to be another series of books that I'm writing. So the series is going to be called the City of Shadows series. Oh. Doesn't that sound spooky? It's with great delight, because I always loved Max as a character, and Meredith. So when I was given the opportunity to bring them back and have a follow-up to that book, I grabbed it. My publisher was quite keen. So that is due out in March next year.
Well, that's not that far away. We look forward to the launch of that. Mm. Excellent, Vanda. Thanks so much for coming in. As I say, I appreciate how busy you are. And, great for you to join us for our final show. And that pretty much wraps it up, people. I want to thank both of my community building guests, I'm going to call you, which is John Russell Hodge and Vanda Simon. And let's go out now with my choice of a Kiwi music track, which has the Christmas theme all over it, but in a nice low-key kind of New Zealand Kiwi way. And this is written and performed by my talented Wellington friend, Chris Jones. So happy holiday, everyone, and catch you in the new year.
What do you want to be when you grow up? They say you are what you read, and the university bookshop can help you be whoever you want to be. Do you want to be an athlete? Then sit down with an inspiring sports biography. Do you fancy yourself as a detective? We have a grisly lineup of murder mysteries waiting just for you. Do you aspire to be the world's greatest chef? We have cookbooks to tantalise your taste buds. Do you want to celebrate your inner child? Play up in our fabulous children's room. The University Bookshop, helping you decide what you want to be when you grow up.
This podcast was produced by ORFM Dunedin with support from New Zealand On the Air.